Greetings, everyone. I thought we'd go ahead and start the Bible study fairly soon now, so to make best use of the time, Mr. Dark's going to have the sermon a little later on this afternoon. So would you all please rise? Our Father in heaven, we thank you very much for this beautiful Sabbath day. We thank you for your protection and intervention in our lives during the week. We thank you for your hand in this work and for the way you're blessing the message that is going out on radio and in the printed page in so many ways. We thank you for the new newspaper that is now in the homes of many thousands of people and for their response and for the magazine. We ask your blessing on every copy and every line, every word of your truth and your word that is going out. We thank you for the willing hand of those who have pitched in to help distribute it and who are having a direct part in your work. We commit this Bible study into your hands and ask for the unseen presence of Jesus Christ to guide and lead and direct in everything. We ask it in his name. Amen. Since I've already been asked one question about the new booklet called When God Shakes the Earth, I guess you've heard about it. What we're going to do is to embark on a little bit of a different booklet format for a series of booklets which will be done in this fashion, justified on the right line as closely as we can do it with our own MagCard typewriter in the office, then photographed and slightly reduced so it looks more like printing and typing, and then printed and just with black and white cover instead of color. Now, this saves us probably $600 per booklet just for typesetting costs alone, and will save us a good bit in printing because the difference in the cost per booklet or per copy, if you go with a color cover as opposed to black and white, is a very great difference. So instead of it being a display booklet, it will have a comparative short lifespan. We probably won't print 20 or 50,000 of them, but just print maybe 4,000 or 5,000. When they're exhausted, won't bother to reprint it. It'll be more or less like an article, more than a booklet of just years and years duration. Now, I thought I'd give you just a little bit of what this one is like. It's called When God Shakes the Earth. The subtitle is Bible Prophecy Says Massive Earthquakes, Tidal Waves, Huge Storms, and Catastrophes in Unimaginable Intensity are to shake this earth just prior to Christ's return. Are we now entering such a time of increasingly devastating natural calamity? Is the eruption of Mount St. Helens only another in a long history of natural disasters, or harbinger of something much worse to come? And then quoting from Isaiah 24:19-21, the earth is completely broken down, the earth is totally rent, the earth is moved exceedingly, the earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage, and the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, it shall fall and not rise again. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Eternal shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. Are all earthquakes, tidal waves, volcanic eruptions, and hurricanes only chance occurrences of natural forces? A study of geologic history would reveal that the recent eruption of Mount St. Helens, for all of its massive scope and far-reaching effect, is but a tiny and insignificant event in an ages-long series of calamitous and catastrophic occurrences that have built such massive mountain ranges as the Rockies, the Himalayas, Pyrenees, Hindu Kush, Alps, Andes, Atlas, and the Cascades of the Pacific Northwest. The very continents themselves, and it's interesting to get into this because we've been in the book of Genesis for quite a few weeks, going through the pre-Adamic creation of possibly innumerable submergences and emergences of the continental land masses, and then, of course, coming to the Genesis flood of the 6th and 7th chapters of Genesis, and talking about what we see on the earth in terms of the mountain ranges and the continents themselves. And I talked about the ring of fire of volcanically active cones, of which there are more than 10,000, of which 600 are active. Mount St. Helens was listed among the 10,000 that are inactive. And so some of those can suddenly erupt, even though they may have been inactive for 100 years or more. And we've been dealing a great deal in the last few weeks with geology and the way the mountains have been formed, and how God has intervened in them. The very continents themselves, their present location, form, and shape, represent mute testimony to monstrous cataclysms that defy human imagination, wherein whole continents were submerged beneath the seas, perhaps emerging and resubmerging many times until the earth as we know it came into being. Certainly, Mount St. Helens' eruption is a major disaster. It will have as yet unknown effects on global weather, perhaps lowering the average temperature in the northern temperate zone so significantly so as to shorten the growing season for years to come by as much as 2 weeks. The long-term effect of substantial amounts of cement-like volcanic ash on fruit trees, grains, leaf, and root crops in a soil is yet to be seen. The immediate effects, while severe enough, are but minuscule in comparison to some of those of recorded history's greatest disasters. The most stupendous explosion ever recorded by man was the blast that destroyed Krakatoa, a volcanic island located in the Sunda Strait between Java and Sumatra. But even this explosion, taking place in 1883, was minuscule in comparison with that which had occurred at some point long prior to any Europeans exploring the region. In that blast, a mountain so large had been blown into the stratosphere that it had left a broken crater ring visible then only as a string of islands which represented the outer portions of the base of an ancient massive mountain which had completely disappeared. As time went on, a new series of cones gradually built inside this ring of islands. The largest of these, Krakatoa, gradually rose to a height of 2,623 feet above sea level. By 1877, the Sunda Strait was being repeatedly rocked by earthquakes. Krakatoa was an uninhabited island whose lower slope, I won't go into all of it, but it talks about that explosion and 5 cubic miles of rock going countless miles into the atmosphere. A shock wave went around the whole world 7 times. A tidal wave of 120 feet tall wiped out 36,000 people. And the sun set for bright red for at least a year, and the effects of it were visible for 3 years. And the major tidal wave went all the way around the Cape of Good Hope and spent itself in the Atlantic and even reached the English Channel, just from an explosion down in what would be the East Indies. Then there's a section on the entire Ring of Fire, a lot of biblical scriptures on earthquakes in diverse places. This is only about a tenth of it, but it will be completed, I hope, in a very few days, at the first of this week, and ready for the press, and it just depends on how quickly the press can have it printed, and hopefully by the end of the week or the first of next week, we'll begin to mail it out. So I'll announce that, hopefully. There will be a Big Sandy Bible study Tuesday evening, June 3rd, at 7:30 p.m. Those who have been attending up there, I'm sure, know the location of that. The conclusion of the study of the three heavens. Mr. Ted Phillips is over in Alabama today, but he'll be back for that Bible study. Are there any questions from the last Bible study we had? I think we concluded with chapter 9, and Mr. Dart went through the occasion of the landing on Mount Ararat and the very beginning experiences of the family of Noah, and of course the experience of Noah in the drunken state. Many of the commentaries are a little bit mixed up on this. It stems in part, as Mr. Dart explained, from the misunderstanding of the Hebrew pronouns. You wonder if Ham was the one who perpetrated this evil act, why was it that Noah woke up and said, "Cursed be Canaan"? We can go over that again real briefly. He awoke in his drunken state, and it said when Ham, the father of Canaan, saw, verse 22 of chapter 9, and I'm reading from the American Standard Version, by the way, when he saw his father lying naked, he told his two brothers outside, whereupon Shem and Japheth took a robe which they put on their shoulders, and walking backward, they covered up their father's nakedness, their faces being turned away, so they could not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and learned what his younger son had done to him. Now here's the question. It's not Noah's younger son. Some commentaries think it means his youngest son, and that son is synonymous with grandson. That seems to be begging the point a little, but it's possible. I think that it's just like in other couple of places, for instance, in the writing of the second tables of stone, and he wrote upon the tables of stone all that he, the eternal, had commanded him. And unless you take, you know, a pen and circle the he and the him and go back to see who you're talking about, the Hebrew pronouns become a little bit confused. God wrote with his own finger even the second tables of the Ten Commandments. But if you read over it very quickly, it appears in the pronoun that it's saying Moses wrote the second set. Not true. In this same case, the he, what his youngest son, meaning Canaan. It's referring back to Ham's youngest son, who is Canaan. So it's referring back to Ham, and it was his youngest son, Canaan, who apparently perpetrated the deed. Then you see, cursed be Canaan is mentioned. The meanest of slaves shall he be to his brothers. There is an interesting article I have, which is a very thorough article on the subject, because of the potential misunderstanding of some black people, I have sent it off to Bronson James and asked for a complete analysis from his point of view. It has to do with the widespread belief of some racists in the United States that the act of Canaan, or in some cases they think Ham, which was an act of sodomy, had actually resulted in the cursing of the family of Ham, which in turn changed their skin to black. And that the black races, there are many major religions that believe this, by the way. It's no small idea that many people that have accepted that the black races are the result of a horrible sex perversion mentioned back here in the ninth chapter of the book of Genesis. The article, of course, totally tears that apart, shows how it's utterly impossible. From this, even in the Middle Ages, it gave rise to the idea, and a part of this also had to do, by the way, with the statement involving the strakes which were pilled, P-I-L-L-V-D, you know, in the time of Jacob, when Laban, of course, deceived Jacob, and he worked 7 more years to get the wife he wanted. And by the time he ended up with those many years of labor, and we'll come to that in due course in the book of Genesis, he had a herd that was many times bigger than the herd he'd started out with. Well, I had never in my life seen any explanation that made any sense of that, but from that derive the idea that if a pregnant mother is frightened by a snake, she may end up with a birthmark of a snake somewhere on the child. And there had been cases where a mother had seen something like a spider or had been frightened by something or other, and sure enough, a child had some kind of a blemish, and this seemed to corroborate this ridiculous idea. But acquired traits or characteristics are not inherited. And of course, the simplest proof of that is, why aren't Hebrew babies born circumcised? Circumcision begins clear back with the family of Abraham and clear back with the time of the Exodus. And from that point on, you know, when Moses was about to go back, lead the children of Israel out, because his own child, born from Zipporah, did not have the sign in his flesh of the covenant between God and Abraham, which covenant was now being awakened and renewed and was being applied with Moses bringing the new nation out of captivity or slavery, God was not going to tolerate the firstborn son of the very emissary himself, who was like an intermediary between God and Israel, not to have the token in his flesh of circumcision. And so it said, he met him in the inn and sought to slay him. And again, you have the pronoun problem. He, God, met him, Moses, and sought to slay him, the son. You find a lot of examples like that. If you have to be very careful about the Hebrew pronoun. And so when Zipporah said, you're a bloody husband unto me, it showed that she still was going along with the Midianitish religion and way of life, and of course they did not circumcise their children. And she did circumcise the boy, and you can read that account. Well, later on, other events would prove, if to those who are really thinking, that acquired characteristics are not inherited. We are not all absent. Not all females are absent one rib. Not all Hebrew babies are born. Matter of fact, none of them are born already circumcised. So that's a ridiculous explanation for it. Do you know the meaning of the cattle who looked and saw these strakes or these branches that were pilled and laid before the watering trough? Some of you ranchers and farmers ought to know the answer to that. It's only because the King James language tends to obscure it, in my opinion. But I think what he did is to discover that you don't even have to dig a hole to make a cattle guard. That all you've got to do is to have what appears to be white stripes before the eyes of a cow, and that cow will not go across. Now, they finally learned that. Years ago, they used to put these big steel rods and railway ties and every type of thing, metal, where a cow, if they stepped in it, they'd break their leg. They just wouldn't go across it. Later on, they learned all they had to do was to paint white stripes across the highway, and the cow wouldn't go across that either. And it wasn't until we were having a Bible study on the way home from the Feast of Tabernacles in about 1954 one time, and we were up in Colorado, and it swung through there, and we're on our way back. I remember Charles Dorsey was with us, and we'd gone up into an area to have a picnic near a stream, and I was reading that portion of the Bible, and in the car, on the way out, we went across a couple of cattle guards. And your tires, you know, go thump. And I don't know why, but it popped into my head, and I went back there, and I looked at that again, and I said, yeah, The only way he could do it was when they came to water. They were sort of semi-wild cattle, and when they would come to water, he managed to make what in effect turned out to be corrals, where the strongest of the cattle that would have the exact characteristics like the splotched or the spotted that he wanted, he could actually lay these strakes down in certain patterns to herd these cattle into a certain area at breeding time. And so what Jacob was doing was practicing selective breeding and ended up with a huge herd. And it was a fascinating study to me at that point in time. Well, all of this I got off on because of the idea that with the eye, we can see the change in the pigmentation of the skin or inherit some kind of birth defects. You know, that was popular even when I was a young boy. My mother told me stories like that other people had told her, and old wives' tales even in the 1930s still claimed that that was true. They would advise young pregnant women not to look at certain ugly things because it might blemish your baby. So that is utterly ridiculous and absolutely not true. Well, then you see the end of the chronicle of the life of Noah, and beginning in chapter 10 is what is called the Table of Nations, or the birth of all the children of Noah. Following are the descendants of Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Basically, the Hamitic races went to the south and southeast, and the Japhetic races went basically to the east and the north, mostly the northeast, and up in the area between the Black and the Caspian Sea. And the Semitic races pretty much stayed right in the Mediterranean region and spread out gradually westward. And you can read of all the children. And actually, some of these same names are found in major races and major nations yet today. For example, it says the descendants of Japheth were Gomer and Magog. That became corrupted to Majaj, and of course, eventually became the Moguls, or the people of the Mongolian plains, and some of the more Mongoloid-appearing people of the Russias, Madai, Javan, J-A-V-A-N, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. And many of those peoples are interrelated. Now, each of these would be the progenitor of countless hundreds and hundreds of others who would each of whom spring off into a minor portion of a major tribe. I forget how many races there are, but more than 100, I think, represented in the Union of the Soviet Socialistic Republic, and almost too many to name. But you have Turkomans and Azerbaijanis and Byelorussians and Georgia Russians and White Russians, and you have the people of the Irkutsk and people of the Kamchatka Peninsula. You have the people of the Siberian Plains and on up toward the area that I believe, by the way, is found in Elisha. I don't know where Alaska comes from, Alyeska Indians, but they call themselves the Alyeska, and yet you go back and here is Elisha, one of the sons of those very same peoples who have Oriental characteristics, and I have no doubt came from the land bridge that used to connect the Bering Strait to what is now Alaska and the Aleutian chain with Russia. So the Indians of our Pacific Northwest and the British Columbia, the Yukon, and Alaska, or Alyeska, or maybe Elisha, are very different appearing from the Indians of the South American, Central American, and the American Plain states. The Indians of the Far East, by the way, up around the Lakes region, there were a group that were almost white. They had aquiline noses, and they were called Men of Dan. They were some of the more noble appearing and very intelligent of the Indian tribes, and their tribal name was Mandan. And it's fascinating to me that they perpetuate the myths. You know, I suppose you were taught in school that Columbus discovered America, which is a blatant lie, of course. It's been disproved for centuries, but why people continue to cling to it, I'll never know. But, of course, the Icelandic people had colonies in what they called Vineland for centuries and centuries before Columbus was ever heard of. And the peoples who discovered it were far more ancient than even that, because when the Vinelanders got here, this continent was already inhabited. And the peoples who inhabited this continent, of which there are hundreds and hundreds, we used to have a little kind of a quiz driving along in a car on a way to hunt, you know, that we'd talk about. We'd try to come up with at least 100 Indian tribes. Not too difficult if you just start. You'd even start out with states, and you'd think of Ohio, and you got the Kiowa and the Ohio and the Iowa and all that area where the Kiowa or the Ohio Indians. And the same thing is true of some of the northern states, Michigan, for example. And up where I came from, there were the Klickitats and the Multnomahs and on and on. So Chicago, by the way, is named an Indian chief. We think, I suppose, that cities in Australia are strange when it says Coolgardie or Kalgoorlie or Wirra Wirra or something like that, cities in Australia. But it looks equally strange to see cities named after Indian chiefs in the United States. All over the area, Ouachita appears spelled about three different ways, like Wichita, Kansas, and O-U-C-H-I-T-A for the Ouachita River are actually the same name, just from the Ouachita tribe of Indians that inhabited the Arkansas Hills. Well, enough of that. It's very interesting when you get into some of the derivations of the tribes of the earth. The descendants of Gomer, verse 3, were Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarmah. The descendants of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Rodanim. Tarshish is mentioned in Ezekiel 27 as being a major seafaring nation. It's interesting to me that Javan and Japheth, the first letters are J-A. In the case of Javan, it is J-A-V, and then if you follow it, J-A-V-A. Where is the island of Java or of Javan? Where is the land of Nippon or of Japan today or of Japhetic people? One of the major seafaring nations of the world, the major sea power of the recent history, and even going back to ancient times, has always been Japan. And various clans, nation by nation, are mentioned. The descendants of Ham, verse 6, were Cush, Egypt, you may say Ethiopia, or Put. Actually, Ethiopia should be translated Put, and Canaan. The descendants of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, and Sabtika. The descendants of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. The queen of Sheba, I believe, did not come from Ethiopia, but I believe she came from India. But it's just my own opinion. Some, including Emmanuel Velikovsky, have identified her with the Hatshepsut of the East African highlands or the Ethiopian area, very much in the north part, the south part, or upper Egypt. But I'm not totally convinced of that. It is possible. But because of the dealing of Solomon and the trade of his ships that brought peacocks and apes, as well as ivory, from a nation of people that were very dark-skinned, it would seem to indicate, since peacocks and peafowl are native of India, as are prodigious numbers of monkeys and so on, as well as elephants, the Indian elephants, and African elephants were tamed by Hannibal, but nevertheless, it didn't make all that much of a great gift in those days. So it's interesting to look into where these people settled and try to find where they are in biblical prophecy. We come very quickly to Cush, the father of Nimrod, who was the first person on the earth to be a despot, it says here in the American Revised Standard. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal, or in the sight of God, hence the saying, as mighty a hunter in the sight of the Eternal as Nimrod. I find it fascinating that in the Masonic temple, isn't it, they still have reference to Nimrod in some of their rites. I don't know, but you know, even to this day in sports magazines or in articles about hunting and fishing, they'll talk about all you Nimrods, because it became a synonym for sportster is a Nimrod. They probably even have manufactured commodities of sporting goods named Nimrod. I think there's a Nimrod tent or maybe a fishing rod or something of that nature. Nimrod apparently began to gather people together in towns, groups of and clusters of homes as villages, and then build walls around them because there were tremendous numbers of wild animals becoming very prolific. Some have speculated that the reason for the first cities was from protection motives, to erect walls around the cities and to have walled villages, and therefore to have the cattle and the domestic creatures inside the walls, that it was more like a suburban area, not the way we think of a city, but a wall surrounding thousands of acres in which cattle and people freely could live, but the walls would keep out predators and wild animals. Of course, there were lions in the area. The nucleus of his kingdom, we're going very swiftly over a chronicle here that took literally centuries, of course, was Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Some of those have been excavated, by the way, as Halley's Bible Handbook relates. From that region, he pushed out into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, and Resen, the large city lying between Nineveh and Calah. Egypt was the father of Ludim. Now, they translated Egypt here instead of, I believe the word would have been, what is it in your Bible? Is it Ethiopia? Back in verse 6, between Cush and Put, what is the word? Mitzrayim? Oh, yeah, Mitzrayim, okay. They translated Egypt. Was the father of Ludim, Ananim, Lehabim, Naphtuhim, Paphrusim, Kashluhim, and Kaphtorim, from whom the Philistines sprang. Canaan was the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and the city, of course, in the land of Canaan is still there to this day, Sidon. By the way, the claims of one church, which unfortunately were plagiarized in a booklet, I won't go into that, many, many years ago, it was a very unfortunate booklet, on the subject of the proof of the Bible, that actually tried to, quote, defy the skeptics and agnostics by daring them to go over there and build a city on the site of ancient Tyre. Well, that's all well and good if you're writing to absolutely ignorant people who are so obtuse as to never investigate even a simple encyclopedia, or so ignorant that they have never merely picked up the telephone and maybe called Lebanon and asked them if there is such a city. But in any event, I was very shocked, I have to tell you that, when I got there and saw it. And you're driving through Tyre, which is pronounced sewer, but T-S-U-R, meaning Tyre in their language, and right on the site of ancient Tyre, and here are blatting, honking taxi cabs and stoplights and tourists milling around, you know, and hotels and motels and restaurants, and the city of Tyre, where the pictures in the booklet showed the spreading of nets in its desolate area. Well, the only way you could take those pictures is be sure to watch your camera angle, because if you just took the pictures out to sea and you got the remnants of the causeway that was built by Alexander the Great to go from old Tyre to new Tyre, then, of course, that is true. The point that the Bible made was that it, the city of Tyre, that city under that government built that way, would never before be built, because it was utterly destroyed, and even the very dust of the earth was taken and put into the Mediterranean to form a causeway to get to new Tyre by the armies of Babylonia, Alexander the Great, to destroy it. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed old Tyre, and Alexander the Great destroyed the new city, which had been built offshore. The causeway gradually, the Mediterranean winds coming out of the north, caused the tremendous deposits of silt and sand to be blown, which gradually filled in the shoreline until today. It is only like a little bulge in the shoreline where it used to be an island offshore. And now, right there, where that new Tyre used to be, is a modern city. And not very far from that is a modern city called Sidon. Here's Sidon mentioned in Genesis 10, and there's a city on the former Syro-Phoenician seacoast named Sidon in the exact location of the ancient city right now today. Where was I here? Yeah, verse 16. His firstborn, and then of Heth, also the Jebusites, and the Amorites, the Girgashites, and Hivites. Now you're getting into some of the tribes that were there when the Israelites began to inherit the land. The Arkites and Sinites, the Arvadites, Zemarites, and the Hamathites. Later, the Canaanite clans scattered until the territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon in the direction of Gerar as far as Gaza. Now, that basically means the entire Lebanese and Israeli seacoast as far as the Gaza Strip, which has been claimed, of course, by the Palestinians and formerly Egypt. And in the direction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and by the way, that's in the Salt Plain, there is still a town there. It is called Sedim, S-E-D-I-M. The Israeli government maintains a chemical plant, and because of the tremendous mineral and saline quality of the waters of the Dead Sea, you can see as you drive along on the road that comes from Jerusalem down toward Jericho, you turn right and you go along the west bank of the Dead Sea, and at the very tip of it, just as you're ready to leave the Dead Sea shore and go on down to Aqaba or down to Eilat on the Israeli side, there's a little town called Sedim. And there is a factory out there, and you can see all the dikes and the pools where they allow a process of evaporation to result in the crystalline formation of various types of chemicals, potash and other things, I guess, that they're getting out of the area for fertilizers. They have claimed, I've never gone out to sea, that the Dead Sea is basically about two-thirds bigger than it used to be in the days of Abraham, and that the lower half or two-thirds of it averages only 4 feet deep. And that the deposition of silt over the many, many years from the Jordan River, which is basically a pretty muddy river, has so filled up the bottom that it caused the waters to gradually spread over what was once a salt plain. And, of course, it's very saline. I've been swimming in it. My sons have been swimming in it. I've got pictures of them out there. And your body is only halfway in and out of the water. You can almost sit up. in the Dead Sea. You can go out and you can swim in the Dead Sea. People have perpetuated the myth, by the way, the Dead Sea doesn't have any light. That's absolutely not true. You can chase little old fish in the shallows. There are a lot of fish in the Dead Sea. I've seen them with my own eyes, so I know they're there. Anyway, it's interesting. They claim that you can pole out there on that 4-foot depth of water, and you can actually see the foundations of what might have been ancient buildings. And tradition has it, then, that the location of ancient Sodom and Gomorrah were in an area that is now covered by the waters of the southern part of the Dead Sea. And I think that's very fascinating. All right, going along a little more. These were the descendants of Ham, and by these, and languages, country by country, nation by nation. Children born to Shem, and all of those are listed. I'm not going to go through and list them all. You can study the rest of the 10th chapter. In the 11th chapter, we come to the Tower of Babel. I want to, again, explode another myth. I've heard this preached. I grew up hearing this preached. I used to cringe when I heard it preached, but I couldn't get it changed and couldn't do anything about it. I've heard it preached over and over again that men were going to build a tower to get to heaven. Man was trying to get to heaven. I thought, well, that's pitiful. But, you know, no human being, even an ancient human being, could be so profoundly stupid as to go into a very low-level plane near sea level and start grubbing around and making bricks and building a stupid tower which wouldn't reach above the height of the nearest low little foothills that he could see in the distance. And with peaks soaring up to 14,000, 16,000, 19,000, and up in the Pamir Knot, and even in the area where the Ark descended, if he'd gone further into the Hindu Kush, he gets up above 22,000 feet. It would seem to me that if man wanted to get to heaven, it would be a whole lot easier to take a backpack and a walking stick and simply start climbing the highest mountain in sight. And after he got up there, if he wasn't too winded, he could turn around and start building a tower on the top of that